To recap what we did last session, I think this will be a useful orientation, and I've sort of, our conversation last time helped me adjust some of my thinking or reframe it accordingly. Let's lay out the broad narrative of where we are and where we're going. Our focus, at least the last couple of times, has been on Minim. People that we normally translate as heretics, but that we saw it's a great deal more complicated than that. It's not just Minim is not the Hebrew word for people who don't believe correct things, which is what heretics, as we saw, the word heresy itself has a complicated history. Heretic doesn't just mean heretic as it's used in some of the later Christian writers means people who have incorrect beliefs. That is included in the category, in the rabbinic category of Minim, but it's not limited to that. It's just people who separate themselves from the community, either by creating social divisions in the community, by having different practices than what the community has, or in some cases by believing things that are considered incorrect belief. We know, and we started to take a look at this last time, that there is a prayer that develops that targets the people in this group, Minim. What we saw when we examined who the Minim are, we saw that it doesn't really seem to designate anybody in particular, any particular community. It's not as if there's a community that you could look at and say, these are Minim. A Min seems to be sort of a typological character. So this is important because the story that you usually hear when we hear about Birkas HaMinim, the blessing in the Shemona Esrei, that is directed at the Minim, is that this was the tool, it sort of fits into a neat little story, this was the tool that was wielded by Jewish leadership, and Jewish leadership is taken to be pretty straightforwardly the rabbis, so everything that we've learned up until now should make us already very suspicious of this claim. The leaders of the Jewish people who are taken to be the rabbis crafted Birkas HaMinim at a council which was taken to be held at Yavne. And this was where they decided who was in the Jewish people and who was out. And the people who were thought to be out, and this was taken to be a momentous decision made by the rabbis, by Jewish leadership, were the Christians. And Birkas HaMinim is the tool that was wielded to shove the Christians forcefully out of the Jewish people. The implicit claim here is that Minim equals Christians. And when we say Birkas HaMinim, this is taken to mean the curse against the Christians. Now, this is important because our later copies, much, much later copies, of the text of Birkas HaMinim, so the earliest copies that we have, the earliest evidence that we have for the actual text of Birkas HaMinim, as an entire sort of full text, is from the Kairo Geniza. These texts are from, the earliest ones are from the 900s, and so this is, as we'll see, this postdates our actual evidence by a good at least 600 years. And if we know anything about the Siddur, it's that the text of the Siddur is not stable. So if you were to open up a Birnbaum Siddur, and then you were to open up an Art Scroll Siddur, you would already see some differences. So if the text of the, in the age of printed text, if the text of the Siddur can change within the course of 20 years, imagine how much it can change over the course of several hundred years. So it's true that the early texts of the Geniza have references to Christian, to Notzrim in particular. That shouldn't necessarily give us any confidence that that was the original text, if such there was, of Birkas HaMinim. So what we have to do is look afresh at the evidence that we have for the existence of Birkas HaMinim, try to figure out at whom it is directed and what its purpose is. So to take a look. So for some of us, this is Chazara. But for others, this will be fresh, and I'd like to look at it with together. Take a look at source A1. This is our earliest source that references Birkas HaMinim. The Tosefta tells us, Shmona Esrei Brachos Shamar Chachamim Keneged Shmona Esrei Askaros Shebahavu LaHashem Bnei Elim Kol Shal Minim Mishal Paroshim Mishal Gerim Mishal Zakenim Mishal David Bivani Yushalayim Im Amar Elalatzman Elalatzman Yatza. The 18 blessings that the sages said correspond, in other words, the 18 blessings of the Amida correspond to the 18 mentions of God's name in Psalm 29. And some details in terms of what blessings one recites as part of these 18. So, the blessing of the Minim, which is what we're interested in, is included in the blessing of the Paroshim, the people who are Poroshim at Sibor, the separatists. And the blessing of the Gerim, of the converts, is included in that of the elders. And the blessing concerning David is included in that in the blessing of the builder of Jerusalem. And if you recited each one of these several brachos individually, presumably if you recited more than 18, in other words, that's okay too. Now, Couple of questions. What does this source tell us about Birkas Aminim, and what does it tell us about Shemona Esrei more generally? So first of all, let's start with the second question first. What do we know about Shemona Esrei from this source?
There's an inclusion.
So there's an inclusion, which is to say, and as Sally's saying, it has to correspond to something.
Right.
So when we say that it corresponds to the mentions of God's name in Psalm 29, so what does that tell us about how many brachos there can be? But presumably, there's a limit to how many brachos there can be. How many brachos can there be according to this Tosefta?
As many brachos as God's name is mentioned in Psalm 20.
Precisely, 18. Which necessitates, therefore, what in the second half of this Tosefta? So what does the second half of this Tosefta imply about how many brachos there could have been?
No.
Well, in other words, the Tosefta tells us there are 18 brachos. So take the bracha of the minim and include it in the bracha of the, and stick it into the pre-existing bracha of the paroshim. Take the bracha about geirim and combine it with the bracha about zakenim. So this implies, presumably, that how many brachos were there?
There were at least 20.
There are at least 20.
A lot more, but you had to sort of parse
it. Right, there are at least 21, right? Because there's 6 brachos that are mentioned here, and only 3 of them get made. So there are at least 21 brachos. So what that tells us, what does this tell us, in other words, about the history of Shemona Esrei? A person might have thought coming into this source that Chazal invented the Amidah. What does this source tell us?
Probably more brachos, and then they had to combine them.
Right, that sounds like there are brachos floating around in the atmosphere. Chazal are coming along, and as we've seen so many times in our course, the role that Chazal play, even though they do play this role sometimes, but the role that Chazal play here as they do elsewhere is not as lawgiver or legislators, right? They're not legislating new things into existence. They are standardizers. They are taking pre-existing traditions and they are making them into norms and standardized practices. So Chazal are trying to make sense, to make a coherent whole out of a messy reality. So they're taking all these pre-existing brachos that are floating around in the ether. They know that the number 18 is important. So they take the number 18 and they standardize it. Okay. And of these brachos, one of them is the bracha of the minim. Now, if we had to figure out what the... Now, the word bracha, by the way, can mean both blessing and, like, Birkas Hashem is a prohibition. You're not allowed to be Mavarich Hashem. No, Mavarich Hashem can't mean bless God in this context. Of course, you're allowed to bless God. Mm-hmm. Birkas Hashem means curse God. Mm-hmm. So bracha in sort of can mean both itself and its opposite in some cases. There are reasons for this. But the blessing or maybe curse of the minim... What does it have to do? What is its gist? So we don't know anything about the bracha of the minim per se from this source, but we do know what it is included with, what it is thematically associated with. Separatists, right? People who separate from the community. That's the most we know about Birkas HaMinim from this source. Okay. And the sense that we get from this source is that it is part, like the other brachos, a pre-existing bracha that seems to come down to Chazal, and they standardize it into the 18, into the number 18. How do we know the number 18 is so important? Well, all of our Tanaitic evidence indicates this. Take a look at source number 2. From Gamliel Omer, B'chol Yom Mispal Adam Shemona Esrei. Rabbi Shua Omer, Me Ein Shemona Esrei. B'kiva Omer, Im Shigur Tfilas Obefiv, Yispal Shemona Esrei. Vim Lav, Me Ein Shemona Esrei. Rabbi Gamliel says you have to recite 18 brachos in the Amidah. Rabbi Yeshua says you have to recite an abbreviated form of the 18 brachos. And Rabbi Akiva says some people recite the abbreviated form, some people recite the long form version, but everybody agrees that the number 18 is crucial. Okay. So ad kan our Tanaitic evidence, at least from the land of Israel. Now here's where things get complicated. So let's take a look at source B1. Source B1 is the source for that narrative that we had at the beginning, that all of this is something that happens at a council at Yavne, and it ends up being a tool to kick the Christians out. It's usually based on this brisa that is quoted not anywhere in Eretz Yisrael sources, but only in the Talmud Bavli. Tana Rabbanan, Shimon HaPakuli, Hizdir Shemona Esrei Brachos Levnei Rabbi Gamliel Al Haseder B'Yavne. Amar Lahen Rabbi Gamliel HaChachamim, Klom Yesh Adam Sheyodei L'Sakin Birkas Aminim, Amad Shmuel HaKatan V'Tikna, L'Shana Acheres Shachacha, V'Hishkif B'Shnayim V'Shelo Shaos V'Lo HaEluhu. The Brisa tells us that Shimon HaPakuli arranged the 18 benedictions in order in the presence of Rabbi Gamliel, B'Yavne, whatever that means. Rabbi Gamliel said to the sages, is there anyone who knows how to be mitaken, how to fix the benediction of the Minim? And in response, Shmuel HaKatan arose and he fixed it. The next year, he forgot what it said, and he stared at it for two or three hours, and even though he wasn't able to recite it, the rabbis didn't remove him. We'll come back to that removing bit in just a moment. But what does this brisa, first of all, what does this brisa imply about, what does this brisa tell us about Shemoneh Esrei that we might not have known and we only read the other sources?
Maybe it is actually very old, and then it had to be remembered.
Ah, right. So Shmuel HaKatan sort of creates it, and then immediately he forgets it, right? So maybe it's just the sort of thing that he didn't create. In other words, we assume if he created it, he should have remembered it.
But even when Rabbi Gamliel says, is there anyone who could be mitakein? So, but does that mean that, like, it already existed and it got confused? So can you now fix it and restore it to what it used to be, and now something happened, and now we need to restore it?
So what Sally's picking up on is the word mitaken, which sounds strange here. Why is mitaken sound strange to us?
They're not creating.
How would you have translated mitaken? How would you have translated that root had we not learned the Tosefta and the Mishnah that we already read? How would you want to translate mitaken? What is a takana usually? A takana is what? Well, so, no, right, that would be a klala, right, a curse, but a takana usually would be an ordinance, right, a decree, something that the rabbis usually create not necessarily out of nothing, but create as a new law. When the rabbis innovate something, we call that a takana. So to be metakein something means to decree something. Now, the reason why I'm trying to translate metakein here as fix rather than decree, which is how you would naturally translate it, is because we learn the Tosefta and we learn the Mishnah, and we know that the notion of decreeing doesn't fit with the Tosefta and the Mishnah, because the Tosefta and the Mishnah implied that there is a standard number 18 that the rabbis want to fit everything, that the rabbis want to standardize, and they're taking all these brachos that are floating around, and they fit them into the number 18. This source in the Bavli sounds a little bit different. It sounds like the rabbis create something out of nothing, and they decree the Birkas Aminim. The Birkas Aminim is something that they innovate. And in fact, in what other way is this brisa different from the Tannaitic material from Eretz Yisrael? How many brachos are there in this one?
18 plus 1, 19,
right? So this source differs from the Eretz Yisrael material as well in postulating that the number 18 no longer has to be followed so closely. So that's another way in which this source is different. So now you can, yeah.
So, but Rabbi Gamliel is still the head of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, right? Yeah.
So the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah seems to be a thing of the past. But that's an excellent observation. Rabbi Gamliel, we're assuming here, is the head of something because he seems to be directing all this traffic.
If he's the head and it's a new takana, then he should have been the one to be mitakenet. But I thought it sounded like, because he's the head, so if it's, then he's just asking, is there somebody who can fix what we have? I don't know.
Right.
Because otherwise he should have done the takana. I mean,
right.
Why is he asking someone else to do it?
Right. So why is there, so it sounds like if you have a story, I think Sally is substantially correct. If you have a story where someone's saying, does anyone know how to do X? Usually what that person is asking is, does anyone remember how to do X? Right. So the way the story is told sounds like the kind of story that we know from the Mishnah and the Tosefta, but it uses language that might suggest otherwise. Now, my inclination is to read this brisa in conjunction with what we know from the Tosefta and from the Mishnah, since the narrative seems to fit that. You know, the language doesn't fit it so perfectly, but I would like to read it as part of the narrative from the Tosefta and the Mishnah. This bracha of the Birkas Aminim was out there in the ether, and somebody needed to capture it and bring it into the standardized form of Shemoneh Esrei that we know from all the other sources. Historians, however, have not read that passage this way, and they've not read it that way because of the words, I think, because of the words Beyavne. The words Beyavne here, I think, have been among the most ridiculously translated words in Jewish history. They're usually read as, the way I've translated it here, Shimon HaBakuli arranged the 18 benedictions in order in the presence of Rabban Gamliel at Yavne. We did this exercise last time, but it's worth doing again. What is the difference between at Yavne and in Yavne? So I'll give you the example I gave last time. If I told you two people came together and they made a major decision in Geneva versus two people came together and they made a major decision at Geneva, what is the difference between those two sentences? If I told you two people came together and made a major decision in Geneva, so I could have said they made a major decision in Long Island. I could have said they made a major decision in Chicago. It just is telling you where they made a major decision. But if I tell you they made a major decision at Geneva, what does that imply? What's the first thing that comes to mind when I tell you they made a major decision in Geneva?
The Geneva Conventions. It changes the definition of changes Geneva.
Yeah, Geneva becomes the place of a specific event rather than just the geographical location. Now the words Beyavne can just as easily mean in Yavne. This is where this conversation between Rabban Gamliel and other people happened. It has traditionally been translated as at Yavne, as if something very important happened at Yavne. Some specific event happened at Yavne. This is where you get the notion of a rabbinical council, where they made all these decisions about kicking people kicking the Christians out of Judaism. There actually is a model. There is a historical model upon which this notion of Yavne is based. And what is that? Now remember, the people who are sort of utilizing this model in a very early period are mostly Christians. So what model are they working with?
You mean what the word means?
Yeah, in other words, in imagining that the rabbis came together, all the rabbis of representing different, streams of Judaism. Yeah, they come together and at a council and they make big decisions. So the Council of Nicaea, they're thinking of the major early church councils at which people came together and hashed out doctrine. So that's what they're imagining the rabbis are doing. I don't think that's a very good model, A, because we don't have evidence for it, and B, because I think it's just sort of stooping Christianity in Jewish history, which is the last thing that we need, right, when we're trying to read these sources. I don't think it's a justified way to read this sugya. Nothing about the sugya necessarily demands it. However, you should know that there is, in Jewish history, we'll skip it for now, there is a notion that that interesting things, formative things for the history of halacha happened at Yavne, like the decision to paskin like Beis Hillel over Beis Shammai. But again, I don't think this necessarily means anything more than in Yavne, like, or at the time of when the rabbis were in Yavne. I don't think there's any evidence from any of our sources that there was ever sort of a council at Yavne at which Birkas Aminim would have been a major decision by the rabbis. If anything, as we've seen from our sources so far, Yavne seems to have functioned not as a council, but simply as a time period during which, the early Tanaim, Chazal, drew together many of these early brachos that people were reciting as part of the Amidah, took them all together, standardized them into an 18 bracha format, and made that the practice going forward. And Birkas Aminim, as best as we can tell from all of these sources, seemed to be directed at people who are separating from the community. Okay.
The city of Yavne, because if you look on maps in the time of Yehoshua, you don't really hear about a city of Yavne.
Right.
So is it something that got its name from everything that was happening there, or that it was the name change,
right,
Yavne, or that they changed? Because we don't hear about it in Sefer Yeshua or Shoftim.
Right. So Yavne. Right. So Yavne, as far as I know, the origins of Yavne are shrouded in mystery. We don't really know so much about Yavne. All we know is that there are major rabbinic figures there after the first revolt against the Romans, Yeah, I think, many of the early historians assume there was this big council there, but I don't know if you have evidence. So now the question that we have to ask ourselves now is, can we figure out what this bracha said? So the first source in source number 2 we've already seen, it's the source of the Tosefta from earlier. It seems to say, what word do we seem to know for sure is in the bracha? Minim, right? That's all we seem to know. And minim seems to mean something similar to paroshim, or something must have a sort of similar theme to paroshim, to separatists. That's all we know. The Yerushalmi has a similar version of this Tosefta, by the way, but note the differences. The Yerushalmi, the second source in number 2, tells us, V'atani, kolal shalminim v'shalposhim v'machnia zedim. One includes the benediction of the minim and of the sinners in He who humbles the insolent. Okay, so a couple of things. What are the differences between this Yerushalmi and the Tosefta? So the first one is what was the larger bracha in which Pirkas Aminim was included in the Tosefta? Right, the ones for the separatists, for the paroshin. What's the larger superstructure of the bracha in which Minim is included in the Yerushalmi's version of the Brisa?
Sinners.
Yeah, well, it's included with the sinners, but in Machnia Zaydim, which seems to be either a new bracha or another version of a bracha that we've never heard about before. But Machnia Zaydim is now the big overarching structure, and Minim and Poshim are included in it. Now, where do we get the poshim, the sinners, from? Where did that come from? So if I had to guess, so remember, this is the Yerushalmi's version of a Tosefta. The Tosefta said, Kol al shalminim v'shal paroshim, and here we have Kol al shalminim v'shal poshim. And those things sound quite similar. I think two things might have happened. Either the Yerushalmi is interpreting what it thinks paroshim is, right? What are paroshim? They're poshim, they're sinners. Or the word paroshin was unclear, and the Yerushalmi interpreted it by saying it probably means poshin. It means sinners. Okay. So we get another sense of what minim might mean, and we also get some more words that might have been in the bracha, machnia zedim. Okay. The Bavli's version of this is the following. Uma ra'u lomar kibbutz galios ta'achar birkas hashanim. How come we have the bracha about the ingathering of the exiles after the bracha where we ask for sustenance, for parnasa, tichseh, because the verse says, and so forth. Then, v'kevan sheneskab tzu galios, nasa din bar shayim, sheneemar, v'kevan shenasa din bar shayim, kolo haminim, v'kolo zedim imahim, sheneemar, v'kevan shekolo haminim, sromeres karen hatzadigim, tichseh. So the Bavli here is giving us a scheme. It says, first we have the bracha, there's a logical progression. First we have the bracha for sustenance, then we have the bracha for the ingathering of the exiles. After the ingathering of the exiles, we have judgment, judging the wicked, which includes Birkas Aminim, and Zaydim, which presumably is Machnia Zaydim that we heard about in the Yerushalmi. After the judgment of the wicked, we have the reward for the righteous. Okay, so the sense that we get from all of this is that what does the Bavli think Birkas Aminim is? Or what is the Bavli's theological conception of Birkas Aminim? So is it directed at a specific community in the here and now?
No.
I don't think so. I don't think that's the sense we get. What is it instead?
It's a bracha for what will happen after we're all gathered.
Exactly. It's an eschatological construct, right? At the end, meaning the way of the world, that we, the fashion, in other words, or rather the form that we eventually want our world to take in an ideal sense, is one where the exiles are gathered in, the wicked are judged, the righteous are rewarded. So it's an eschatological hope. One day the wicked will be judged. If we prayed in our synagogues in English and we said, blessed is God who judges the wicked, that wouldn't necessarily be a statement about anybody in the room in particular, or anybody outside the room in particular. It would be a hope that in general, people who are wicked are judged by God. Okay. So we have no evidence at this point, A, for the text of the bracha, other than that it's about minim, and minim, as we've seen, can mean lots of different things, and don't need to necessarily refer to any historical group in particular. We know it's a bracha that seems to be floating around, if our sources can be believed, and even if they can't, in other words, even if we have to read them critically, it's a bracha that was floating around before the Tosefta was written, and probably even prior to the Yavne period. So it's a bracha that is floating around, and even as late as the Bavli, it's not understood to refer to anybody in particular. All of this, to my mind, cuts against the assumption that it's referring to Christians, simply because the bracha in its earliest form doesn't seem to refer to anybody in particular. And even if it does refer to somebody, it's this sort of nebulous category of minim. Now, the earliest source that I think we can identify that implies that the Birkas Aminim is actually being used to and is being directed at actual people is the Tanchuma. The Tanchuma is earliest 5th century and tells us the following. Ha'overlefne is source number 3. Ha'overlefne ha'teva v'ta'a v'lo amar birkas klalas aminim ma'hu shemach ziren oso kach shana raboseinu. Ha'overlefne ha'teva v'ta'a b'chol ha'brachos kulon ein mach ziren oso b'birkas aminim mach ziren oso bal karcho chashin an shem aminhu u'lekach mach ziren oso shemiyya b'tzad minos yiyya mekalalas atzmo v'ha'kahal onin amin. The person davens, says the Tanchuma, and he doesn't say Birkas Aminim, So how do we know that we have to make him repeat the bracha? Because we have a general principle, and there are many earlier sources from the Tanaim even, that's, or rather from a little bit later than the Tanaim that say this, that the if you're repeating Shemoneh Esrei, you're the Chazan, and you forget Birkas Aminim, you have to go back. And the Tanchuma goes even further and says, not only do we have to go back, not only does he have to repeat it, and if he doesn't repeat it, we just don't let him be the Chazan, we make him repeat it, because if he's a Min, we want the entire community to marginalize him, right? We want him to curse himself, and the entire community will say Amen. So where, now, if it's true that a person who is in Shul might forget Birkas Aminim, so it's clear that Chazal, at least in theory, can envision what? Who's coming to daven in shuls that Chazal would have been in?
People are not minim.
Right, so there are certainly lots of people who are not minim there. But if Chazal are concerned that a Chazan might be a min, so even the Chazan, so presumably, the Chazal can imagine that there are people in shul whom they might consider minim. Now, we might think, we might assume, we have no reason to assume otherwise, if there's somebody who's davening in a shul that is reciting Birkas Aminim, so presumably they don't consider themselves minim, right? Presumably they think what they're doing is fine. Now Chazal, however, are concerned that if a person skips Birkas Aminim, he might himself be a min. Therefore, we have to make him go back and say it. And if he doesn't want to say it, he can't be the Chazan. Now, all that means is that if you're a min, and you self-identify as a min, and you'd rather not say Birkas Aminim, so the only thing you're restricted from doing in shul, according to this genre of source, is you're restricted from being in the chazan. In the Tanchuma, however, it's clear that if we suspect you of being a min, we subject you to this process where you have to say Birkas Aminim and everybody has to gang up on you. So the Tanchuma provides us evidence that Birkas Aminim is being, I think, used as a tool for the kind of exclusion that the story we told at the beginning tells us happened at Yavne. But again, this source is not until the 5th century, right? So it's not until the 5th century, and we still don't know at whom it is directed. So in the 5th century, we finally have evidence that Birkas Aminim is being directed at people. Okay. Now, of all the sources that have been abused by historians to give us a history of what Birkas Aminim is and at whom it's directed, it's the Christian sources. And this brings us to source 4a. So what evidence do we... Now, whenever we're told that Birkas Aminim is a bracha that was used by rabbis to kick out Christians, the most explicit evidence is usually taken to come from Christian sources, from early Christian sources. The first one is from the fourth gospel, the Gospel of John. John tells us, he's telling us about a story where Jesus is said to perform a miracle, and the parents of the person for whom the miracle was performed are asked to confirm that such a miracle was done. And the verse tells us his parents said these things, in other words, they didn't explicitly confirm the miracle, because they feared the Jews, for the Jews had already agreed that if anyone will confess Jesus to be Christ, he will be put out of the synagogue. The word is aposunagogos. He will be put out of the synagogue. Does this refer to Birkas Aminim or not? And how do we know?
Well, it doesn't say anything about it, so...
Right, well, what's missing here? In other words, what this source tells us that... Let's read it straight for a moment. Let's say this source is assuming that there are Christians and there are Jews, and those two groups are not the same people. And the Jews, according to this verse, say that if anybody says they're a Christian, they get kicked out of shul. Do we have evidence that this was the case for Birkas Aminim? Again, what happens if you're in a shul and you don't say Birkas Aminim? What happens to you?
You're supposed to repeat it.
If you're the Chazan, what happens if you're not the Chazan?
Nobody would know.
No one knows, right? Let's say you are the Chazan. You have to repeat it. Let's say you don't want to repeat it. Until the Tanchuma, well, and the Tanchuma says that you're forced to.
Right.
What about our earlier sources? You just can't be the Chazan, right? Ha'aluhu. They remove you from being
you're
the
fired.
Chazan. You're fired. Yeah. Right.
But you could still be in the shul.
Yeah, right, presumably, right?
I heard KJ yesterday. I like that. Yeah.
He wouldn't say Birkas Aminim?
He wouldn't say Birkas Aminim,
no.
That's a problem.
I once know it, and Joe looks to him. They said Hallel, and the Chazan refused to say Hallel with a bracha.
So that was that.
Fire.
Maybe he was Sephardic, so he didn't say what the prophet.
Ah, you're a Pasas Ligur Lavadja. Okay, perfect.
That's only the most you know about those things.
I don't think he probably wasn't Sephardic then.
All right, so the. Right, okay, so in such a case, you have. You have presumably you have lots of people in shul. Some of them possibly believing that Jesus is a significant figure in their lives, either because he's the Messiah or something else.
Well, that's what Christ means.
Right? Yeah, he's right. Christos. He's
and
the
why
Christ.
Why would they go into the synagogues? Because
they didn't know what they were.
So this brings us actually. That's a good question. That
and
actually.
A lot of classes.
Well, that's
used to go to shul.
Right. Well, that's another important question because that brings us to another issue with the. Well, that brings us to another important point about the fourth gospel. The vast majority of scholars who read John nowadays understand, and there's plenty of evidence. If we were doing a class on John, we could go through it. There's plenty of evidence from the Gospel of John that the Gospel of John is not, when it refers to Jews, it's not referring to all Jews as opposed to all Christians. The Gospel of John identifies as in continuity with the Jewish people. When it talks about Jews, it's referring to the particular leaders of the synagogue at the time of the Johannine community. At the time that the community that's writing John is writing, it refers to Jews. The Jews, when it refers to them pejoratively, and it doesn't always,
right.
When it refers to the word, when it uses the word Jew pejoratively, it means the leadership of the Jewish leadership in its community that it was to whom the community of John was opposed. Okay. So here, and I will say also, there's no evidence that any of this is taking place in a liturgical context. You can be in a synagogue for a number of reasons: to read scripture, to congregate, to schmooze.
To take a class.
To go, if you're in the Jewish center, once upon a time, to go swimming, yeah. Right? There are lots of things you can do in a shul. There are lots of things you can do in a shul.
I had dances.
right. Okay. I'll save that for another history class. So there's no evidence that any of this is taking place while there's davening going on. So John can't be a source that Birkas Aminim is instituted at an early period, as early as 95 CE, to kick Christians out of the synagogue. Take a look at sources for B, C, and D. These are from Justin Martyr, a second century source, a little bit later than John. Usually these sources are also taken as evidence that there is some sort of early prayer directed at the Christians, and that prayer is taken to be Birkas Aminim. All of this evidence we have to examine very closely. 4b, but you were never shown to be possessed of friendship or love either towards God, says Justin, or towards the prophets or towards yourselves. He's talking to a Jew here. But, as is evident, you are ever found to be idolaters and murderers of righteous men, so that you laid hands even on Christ himself, and to this very day you abide in your wickedness, execrating those who prove that this man who was crucified by you is the Christ. So Justin here says that Jews are execrating those who prove that Jesus is Christ. Presumably he's referring to people who, like Justin, are Christians. And this is taken to be evidence for Birkas Aminim. Why? So what do you think about this claim? What's the problem? What's missing here? In order to claim that cursing Christians is equals Birkas Aminim, where is Birkas Aminim said? When do we say Birkas Aminim? Shemona Esrei, in the Amidah. When do you say where do you say the Amidah? If you're doing the right thing, you don't say Amidah. Yeah, well, you don't. In other words, you don't say Amidah in the office. You say Amidah.
Yes.
You can. Well, nowadays in Manhattan, I don't know what the story is. Right? You have a minyan in Manhattan, but you say it in shul, right? There's no synagogue here. Justin doesn't say you curse Christ in the synagogue. He says you just curse Christ. That could presumably refer to anybody. Sources 4C and 4D. We're going to skip now, just in the interest of time. But they have similar problems. I don't think that there's any evidence from Justin. That Jews are specifically cursing Christians in their synagogues. So the picture that we have is that at least until the 2nd and 3rd century of the Common Era, we have no evidence either from Jewish sources or from Christian sources that the Jews are saying anything in their synagogues that might be Birkas Aminim that is specifically directed at Christians. So far, the story that we started off our class with doesn't seem to have any support. It's not until the 4th century at the earliest that we have any evidence that this is occurring. So take a look at source 4e from Epiphanius. Epiphanius is writing a catalog of Christian heresies, and among his heresies are the Nazareans, who are sort of people who are like half Christian and half Jewish, according to Epiphanius. He says, not only do yet these are very much the Jews' enemies. Not only do Jewish people have a hatred of them, they even stand up at dawn, at midday, and toward evening, three times a day, when they recite their prayers in the synagogues and curse and anathematize them. Three times a day they say, God curse the Nazareans, the Notzrim, for they harbor an extra grudge against them, if you please, because despite their Jewishness, they preach that Jesus is the Christ, the opposite of those who are still Jews, for they have not accepted Jesus. So Epiphanius tells us, gives us some specifics that we're missing in all our earlier sources. He says, Jews say in their prayers three times a day in the synagogue, God curse the Nazareans. Right. Now, this is not, technically speaking, good evidence, but we know that in the Geniza versions of the text, the word Notzrim is in Birkas Aminim, so it's later evidence, but still, it conforms to the picture that we have from Epiphanius, and what we don't have time to look at 4F, but the source from Jerome confirms very, which is written almost the same time as Epiphanius's work, confirms the picture in Epiphanius, which is that in the 4th century, we begin to have evidence that Jews are specifically cursing Christians in their synagogues. But this is already 300 years after the sages at Yavne convened.
In the synagogue or in their prayers?
In their prayers in the synagogue, well, right. So in Birkas Aminim.
At that time, don't forget, people didn't work an hour away from where they lived, so they went to the synagogue. It's like when we were in Gibraltar. Everybody left their store, and they went to shul to
daven. You go to shul, yeah. Right. So everyone's going to shul. So, to conclude, I think we can say with reasonable to more than reasonable confidence that the story that we started off our class with is inaccurate. In other words, there's no, at least we don't have evidence for any sort of primordial moment at which the rabbis come together at an official council, at an official RCA convention, and they make the decision that Christians are out of Judaism, and they make a specific prayer to accomplish that goal. We don't have any evidence that that occurred. What we do have instead is, I think, something far more interesting, which is we have a move by Chazal to take earlier traditional material that was floating around Judaism, and like we've seen in other cases, they take that material and they standardize it. They take a messy Jewish reality that was in need of shaping by the Balei HaMasorah, and they craft a normative practice out of it for the, I think, purpose of preserving the halacha of Klal Yisrael, and I think preserving a sense of Jewish unity and Jewish purpose. So Chazal take traditions that are floating around and they craft them into something normative. That act of creating something normative then is taken as a baseline out of which later traditions evolve. So by the time, so even though it's true that we have no evidence that Birkas Aminim in its origins, wherever we put that, either before the rabbis or after the rabbis, in its origins is directed at Christians, by the 4th century it became clear, and certainly by the 9th and 10th century, it became clear that Jews had a need in their prayers to make some sort of comment about the threat, whether theological or physical, that Christians pose to the Jewish community, and the method by which the Jewish community expressed that sentiment was by taking the normative practice that Chazal had established even for another purpose, and they adapted it to that. So what does this tell us about how Jewish practice is meant to either evolve or what form it's meant to take as it responds to the needs of modernity, as halacha is always one to do? In other words, halacha as some sort of freestanding enterprise is meant to engage with the challenges of each and every generation. How does that accomplish? I think Birkas Aminim provides us with a model. It is, instead of creating institutions anew, which is the Yavne Council model that we're asked to accept, what Chazal do is actually they take advantage of old traditional formula and adapt it to the needs of the moment. It's a model of slow organic development rather than of radical revolution. And I think that's an important insight that we can take with us as we wade into the hot button issues and the important issues that divide our community today. And with that, thank you all for coming out.
I want to ask you one thing. So in this